taken under advisement. And we'll move to the third case. Third case of the morning, which is United States versus Hankton and Davis.
Is there no time limit when they can file them? Can they hand them to you?
Hell yeah, they send them in after the argument.
Never did when I did.
Which are you? What's your name?
I was waiting for counsel to get seated.
I wanted to call somebody, but I have two names here. Are you Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Public Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Gregory Davis. In this case, Mr. Davis pled guilty to possessing with intent to distribute about 250 grams of powder cocaine. However, his sentence was enhanced based on findings that he was a manager, supervisor in this overall Mickey Cobra's drug operation, and that... Well, at that time, although it's questionable whether this still matters, that he was found responsible for between 50 and 150 grams of crack cocaine. The only problem with that is that doing so, the district court improperly relied on plea agreements of co-defendants, which were unreliable evidence, the exact same type of evidence which this court and the Supreme Court has found is presumed unreliable because they were given with government involvement, indeed, like most plea agreements, probably drafted by the government, recited past events, and weren't subject to adversarial testing. In Lilly, the Supreme Court found that it's highly unlikely that the presumptive unreliability of accomplice statements, which shift or spread blame to others, can be rebutted when they're given under the conditions similar to the old ex parte affidavit practice. And, of course, that's exactly what happened here, and there was no evidence to rebut the presumption. And not only was the error, but it was plain because for many years, courts have found that defendants have a right to be sentenced only on the basis of reliable information. And, of course, the failure to do so affected Mr. Davis's substantial rights. And it's unfair to base a sentence on presumptively unreliable evidence. Doing so would also impugn the integrity and public reputation of judicial proceedings. Now, the government argues that the statements were reliable because they were statements against penal interest. The problem is they weren't statements against penal interest in this context. Yes, there were statements against the maker's penal interests with respect to the pleas they entered, but they weren't statements against penal interests with respect to the statements implicating other people, such as Mr. Davis or Mr. Hankton.
Excuse me.
That's okay. Government also mentions a couple of cases which this court has allowed plus hearsay statements to be used at sentencing. But both of them are distinguishable. In Burke, the primary witnesses actually testified at sentencing, and the other hearsay statements didn't appear to have been made with government involvement. In fact, the opinion makes it appear that they were classic co-conspirator statements made in furtherance of the conspiracy. I'm not sure about the pronunciation there. In that case, it's not clear that the co-defendant statement actually implicated the defendant rather than just corroborating the other evidence, but most importantly, this court didn't discuss the reliability concerns, which later supported its discussion in Jones. Therefore, this court should reverse the district court's sentence and remand for resentencing based on only reliable evidence, which would exclude the plea agreements. And in addition, if this court were to reject the guidelines issue, there's the matter of the Booker error, because Mr. Davis was sentenced on the basis of, or his sentence was enhanced on the basis of facts which were not proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt or admitted by him, and of course the court treated the guidelines as mandatory. So therefore, this court should at the very least issue a limited remand pursuant to Palladino. If it were to reject the guidelines issue, Mr. Davis argues that it should actually issue a full remand for the reasons stated by Judges Ripple and Keeney in their dissents from the denial of rehearing en banc in Palladino, Sixth Circuit, and Barnett in the Fourth Circuit, Hughes.
With regard to the, we'll call it the Palladino remand, since that seems to be the catchphrase, for these various other issues that you raise as far as the cocaine basin and manager supervisor, those come under the guidelines.
That's correct.
And is this, would this Paladino remand address those?
It would not address the actual guideline calculation. It would address, it would ask the district court to determine whether it felt that a sentence within the guidelines was still appropriate, or if it should, now that the guidelines are advisory, sentence outside the guidelines due to the other mitigating circumstances that were not previously relevant.
But would it cause the court to refocus on those two issues that you raised?
I don't.
You think
well,
you
it,
have to have
it
a vacancy?
Could if the court that would be that would probably be up to the court. If the court was disturbed by the preponderance standard, as a few courts have, and thought that now it ought to apply maybe a higher standard or be a little more reticent to fully enhance on that basis, then it would affect it. But I don't believe it would be legally required to revisit those issues.
No, but I was just following along what Judge Mannion said. Certainly, you could ask for that kind of review on a Paladino.
That's correct.
Okay. Is that all you have for now?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. And Ms. Cunliffe?
May it please the court, counsel? My name is Erica Cunliffe, and I represent Clarence Hankton. Whatever this court ultimately determines in resolving how the guidelines should be applied in light of Booker, it must vacate Clarence Hankton's sentence because it was improperly enhanced under two provisions in the guidelines. First, the court improperly increased Mr. Hankton's sentence base offense level by imposing the enhancement for crack cocaine without meeting the legal definition of crack. Second, the court improperly imposed a four-point leadership enhancement in the absence of evidence that Mr. Hankton played a leadership role in the drug distribution offense. With respect to the crack enhancement, to impose the heightened sentence for crack, the government must demonstrate that the substance involved was cocaine hydrochloride boiled with baking soda and water until it becomes a rocky substance. This requirement was made part of the guidelines in 1993. But in concluding that Mr. Hankton distributed more than 500 grams of crack cocaine, the government did not prove that the amount was, in fact, crack cocaine. The enhancement lengthened Mr. Hankton's base offense level from 34 to 36. None of the witnesses that the government presented at sentencing were particularly sure about the quantities of cocaine involved, let alone whether or not any part of that was crack. Agent Darren, who listened to the Title III tapes, concluded that some of them involved narcotics transactions, but didn't know how the crack was made. Jamma Olden was at best reluctant to call the substance crack. Instead of exploring the reason for this reluctance and this confusion about the substance, the government, and perhaps nailing down exactly what this was, the government ignored it altogether and presented the plea agreements of the various co-defendants who had pled guilty, which, according to the government, established that crack cocaine was involved and that these amounts exceeded 500 grams. But the agreements don't do what the government claims they did. At no time, aside from the presumptive unreliability that Mr. Davis's counsel has already argued with respect to the plea agreements don't prove that the substances involved here were crack. Nowhere in this record is there evidence that Mr. Hankton distributed more than 500 grams of a rock-like substance fabricated by boiling cocaine powder with baking soda and water in order to create a rock-like substance. In light of that, there's no reliable evidence that they met their burden in demonstrating that the cocaine was crack. With respect to the leadership role enhancement, in claiming that Mr. Hankton was eligible for the four-point leadership role enhancement, what amounted to an additional 10 years on his sentence, the government introduced letters, some gang memorabilia, and certain Title III phone calls, wherein it's clear, I believe, that Mr. Hankton had some role of authority in the Mickey Cobras. There's one letter where he's addressed by the the person writing it is Dawn of Dawns, which is the evidence shows is up in the hierarchy of the Mickey Cobras. But even with this evidence, the government failed to prove that the enhancement applied in this case because there's no connection between the leadership role in the Mickey Cobras and the drug distribution offense. To apply the leadership role, the guidelines require that the leadership must implicate itself into the offense. Somehow recruiting accomplices, being able to better recruit accomplices, getting a larger share of the criminal proceeds. And as the government noted in its brief, the enhancement's only justified where the government can demonstrate that the defendant had some real and direct influence over others in the criminal activity. The crime here...
Was he responsible for delivering some 500 grams of crack?
He pled guilty to delivering 156 grams of crack.
I said, wasn't he responsible for delivering some 500? I didn't ask what he pled guilty to.
No.
He wasn't?
No, he was not.
All right.
Well, for 106... He was.
156.
What was it? What was
156.
He was.
He agrees.
That's undisputed there.
That's undisputed.
Right. You're just worried about the next bump up, getting
correct.
500 and putting him over another.
Correct.
Couple
you
levels.
Say that wasn't proven sufficiently.
It wasn't proven sufficiently, okay. Because this court has said that, and the guidelines say that crack cocaine has to be baking soda and cocaine powder cooked with water until it becomes a hard rocky substance. And in the absence of such evidence, the court asked the agent, how do you make this stuff? And the agent said, geez, I don't know. I think you mix it with baking soda and maybe a little water, but I'm not sure. And he wasn't sure. And the other witness, the other government's witness, he wouldn't call it crack. He said, you know, you say crack, we don't call it crack. And the government had an opportunity here to really nail down what crack was as opposed to cocaine base, as opposed to powder, and they didn't do it.
Your red light's on. I don't know how you got your time divided. But
I'm done. I've consumed all my time.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this case with you.
All right, thanks. Mr. Shakeshaft.
May it please the court. I'm Tom Shakeshaft, Assistant United States Attorney for the United States. The defendants, the appellants, have raised essentially two categories of issues. The first is the Booker issue, and we briefed this prior to Palladino coming down. And so while for the record I'll preserve the arguments we made in the brief, I'm also familiar that the court has been remanding a number of cases under Palladino and will concede that this appears to fit that mold of case for a limited remand to ask the district court whether or not the district court would sentence the defendants differently had the district court known that the guidelines were advisory. Would simply note the government's position, however, that on the remand, it is the government's position that that decision should be made by the district court exclusively on the record of sentencing at the time of sentencing, because the purpose of the limited remand is to inform this court's plain error analysis. Since this court is retaining jurisdiction, it's our position that an expansion of the factual record in that determination by the district court would be inappropriate. And it is my understanding that if this court does believe that a guideline calculation was incorrectly calculated in the first instance, that the court has been vacating and remanding for resentencing. In this case, it's our position that at most a Palladino limited remand to simply ask the district court whether the district court would resentence differently if it had known the guidelines were advisory is the appropriate remedy in this case. And that is because, and this goes to the second set of issues that the appellants have raised, there was no plain error in the sentencing hearing that took place in this case or in the court's evidentiary findings that support the enhancements that appellants have raised. Namely, each of the defendants has raised the issue of the plea agreements being inherently unreliable. The district court expressly solved that problem by pointing out that there were Title III wiretap tapes for both defendants, Mr. Hankton and Mr. Davis, that corroborated the plea agreements of the co-conspirators that were introduced. So this is not a case where the district court relied exclusively on plea agreements. There was additional evidence that was introduced. Most importantly, these wiretap tapes that are full of the discussion of cooking. So I note that the crack versus powder cocaine difference that counsel has raised was raised, I believe, for the first time in their reply brief. So it is a new issue. It was not raised originally. But even to addressing that, the tapes are replete. The district court made clear that each defendant was responsible for over 50 grams of crack cocaine. And to address each defendant separately, with regard to Mr. Hankton, as the court noted, he pled guilty to 156 grams. The district court found that the Title III wiretap tapes alone account for an additional 450-some grams.
So it was over 500.
So it's over 500. That's based on the tapes alone.
I had read that.
It's over 500 based on the tapes alone. So the plea agreements, really, we wouldn't even need to be considered. They're obviously an additional piece of evidence that corroborate each other, the tapes and the plea agreements. When considered as a whole, the district court clearly said that with regard to Mr. Hankton, he was over 500 grams, in the 500 to 1.5 kilo category. So any error based on the plea agreements, which the government would submit there was none, but even if the court were to find reliance on a plea agreement to be improper, any error was harmless. I think the reliance on the plea agreement was entirely appropriate. And in part, the reliance on the plea agreement was, as this court has said, if that kind of evidence is corroborated and other witnesses testify to it, it takes that indicia of unreliability it solves the problem.
Would you refer to the, we'll call it Palladino remand, where you think, and I'm going to ask you about it, but where the matter goes back and you say it should be confined to the original sentencing hearing and information and no new evidence and all that, as far as the Palladino remand is concerned, the court assesses whether he would have given the same sentence based on all of that. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Given the fact that it's no longer mandatory?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what is going on now? I don't know what's going on when these things come back. You have, I assume,
I've only personally been involved in one. Okay. and made the argument that the district court should rely only on the record at sentencing, and that is, in fact, what the district court did. The reason for that is,
I understand the reason. Do you think, but does that necessitate a directive from us to say that, or is that what they're doing?
It's my understanding that most courts have been looking at the. I can't speak to what every district court's doing. I haven't been following every one, but at least in the cases I've been involved in, they just looked at what happened at the facts and the evidence that the court had at sentencing and is making a determination that. And I think the majority are that they would have come up with the same sentence. I understand that Judge Posner has indicated that if a district court says, I would have given a higher sentence, that does not require a remand, because the defendant obviously was not prejudiced. If the district court responds to this court's inquiry that, well, had I known the guidelines were advisory, I would have given a higher sentence, that ends the remand, that the sentence stands. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Well, my question is just in general terms. I want to know what's going on, that because this is kind of in a state of flux. They're sending a lot of these back, these whole bunch of them all of a sudden, and I want to know if, and you've got a whole lot of district judges, and I assume there's some discussion or standard being set of how they're going to deal with this stuff.
There's all I can tell the court is what the government's argument has been, which is essentially what I have indicated. I don't know what the results are, and I'm not certain that I assume someone is cataloging them, but
we'll know soon enough. I'm just curious what you indicate as far as a directive versus what the practice is. But I interrupt. I know you wanted to go on to Hankton.
No, that's fine. I will just very quickly touch on some of the specific issues as to why This court does not need to vacate the sentencing proceeding. And the first, with regard to the drug quantity for each defendant, is, as I've said, that the evidence that supported the drug quantity of over 50 grams for each defendant was corroborated in Mr. Hankton's case by the Title III wiretaps, as it was with Mr. Davis. The sentencing transcript for Mr. Davis indicates that variety of phone calls with Mr. Hankton himself regarding the distribution of crack cocaine, and the government argued that the 50 grams is in fact a conservative estimate of the amount of crack cocaine.
What about this argument that counsel raised, albeit in her reply brief, about not sufficient testimony as to the difference between crack cocaine, which is boiled, and powder? I mean, I understand you're saying that this is the first time, so we shouldn't even consider it. That would be your first position.
That's correct.
But can you speak to that question?
Well, in this case, there was sufficient evidence about the crack powder distinction from the tapes alone. The defendant, Mr. Davis himself, on the tapes, talks repeatedly, and the district court found that he talks repeatedly about cooking, boiling. In fact, Mr. Davis had gotten to the point, the sentencing transcript reflects, that he was using a microwave oven to create crack cocaine. So the district court, I can't quote it verbatim, but it essentially came to the conclusion that it was clear that this was an individual who had become something of a master in boiling down crack cocaine. So while it's true that the government did not at that time put on an expert, for example, to talk about the process of turning powder cocaine into crack cocaine, the tapes themselves speak about the process. The defendant himself has admitted that that was what he was doing. And so I think that that objection at this point is simply belied by the record that was before the district court. And there's no basis to remand for resentencing on that basis, because the tapes alone demonstrates that was what the defendant was doing. As to the leader-organizer argument, which is the only other one that the appellants have raised here, with regard to Mr. Hankton, there are two different enhancements for two different things. Mr. Hankton was personally held responsible by the district court for distributing a significant quantity of crack cocaine, which is the drug quantity enhancement. He was similarly found also largely on the basis of these tapes and on testimony and on the result of searches that were found at his residence that he was a high-ranking member of the Mickey Cobra organization, and the district court found that the Mickey Cobra street gang in Chicago was a drug distribution entity. That's what it did. So they are different. It's not a double-dipping situation. They are entirely different, and they were both justified. There was abundant evidence of both through his own admissions of Mr. Hankton's drug dealing himself, as well as holding the leadership position of others who were engaged in it. So both of those enhancements were properly applied. With regard to Mr. Davis, similarly, the district court had the opportunity to hear the tapes, heard that Mr. Davis himself had workers, was coordinating with Mr. Hankton where workers were going to, what drug spots they were going to distribute various amounts of drugs in. So similarly, Mr. Davis was personally responsible for a significant quantity of crack cocaine. He was also a leader, organizer, or a manager, supervisor, who coordinated others working for him. And they are two different concepts, and each enhancement was proper. And the last argument that counsel raised in their brief is that somehow or another engaged in double-dipping or double-counting, and for those reasons, that argument is without merit. If the panel has no further questions, I'll conclude.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've got some time left then, Mr. Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. First, returning to the Palladino remand issue, suggest the district court should be allowed to consider new evidence because this court is asking it what it would do now under the standards of Booker, and in order to determine that, it's got to be able to consider all the facts that are now relevant under Booker that it may not have considered before because they weren't relevant.
So what does it tell us that so that we allow a vacate and remand, or is there some other middle category where it would be remanded eligible for a new hearing as opposed to remanded to determine based on the record that's already there?
Well, this court at this point is simply doing the limited remand, asking the court, would you now right. like to resentence the defendant? So
you want more than that?
Well, obviously, yes. And that's what we're arguing for in every case in the district court, is that it should answer the question, telling this court, yes, it would give it another sentence, and that it, in the process of making that decision, can consider any additional evidence which we're able to come up with within the time frame available, or perhaps that was on the record but wasn't important before.
Didn't the court say it would deprecate the seriousness of the offense if he didn't give him this much?
It did, but in this context, that doesn't mean much because he still sentenced Mr. Davis at the low end of the guidelines range, and there was no argument for departure. So we don't know whether the court meant that he didn't think a lower sentence was reasonable or if it was just speaking to the audience.
Higher too.
I'm sorry, what?
You want to take a chance of going higher, too.
There is theoretically that possibility, although I think it's very unlikely on its record since
the lower end.
Correct.
You don't think he's going to go much lower, do you?
I don't know. We certainly have that hope.
If he makes this comment, if I went any lower, I would depreciate the seriousness of the offense.
That, as I said, the importance of that comment is unclear. He may have been speaking to the audience, speaking to Mr. Davis, trying to make him feel a little bit better about the lengthy sentence he was getting. We don't know because he didn't have any choice of going lower. So right. It's somewhat of a gratuitous comment, which may or may not have any meaning.
From my understanding.
Well, we.
That's right.
And getting back to the plea agreements, it's true that there was other evidence in support of it, but the district court specifically relied on the plea agreements in addition to the other evidence. So we don't. You know, the court may very well have found that the other evidence standing alone was insufficient. In addition, the corroboration may have been because the government drafted the plea agreement so that they would corroborate and be corroborated by the remaining evidence. Of course, findings based even partially on unreliable evidence are still unreliable. That's kind of like computers where they used to say garbage in, garbage out. I'm sure co-counsel would like me to mention the distinction in Edwards was over the use of baking soda, not the rest of the cooking process, and that may be important, especially for her client. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. This case will be taken under advisement, both of them. Ms. Cunliffe, if I understand, you were court-appointed, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Both of you, okay. Well, anyway, appreciate your good work for your clients. We're going to take a slight interlude here because the Circuit Executive Collins Fitzpatrick informs me that we have some admissions from law clerks, so we'll proceed with that.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm pleased to move the admission of four law clerks to the court this morning. Peter Flanagan received his undergraduate